Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Stever, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Lithium powers our modern lives. Everything from phones, computers, even cars can run on rechargeable batteries made from this soft, silvery white metal. Lithium batteries store energy collected from solar and wind farms. In fact, the race towards net zero emissions runs on lithium. But this cure for carbon emissions causes environmental problems of its own, which is why scientists are searching for an alternative to the lithium battery. Shirley Meng is a professor of molecular engineering at the University of Chicago, where she researches new battery technologies. Professor Meng, welcome to All Sides. Let's start with the basics. How does a battery actually work?
Glad to be here. The batteries is a device where we convert the chemical energy and electrical energy reversibly. So when we actually charge our batteries, we're making a mini chemical plant to make those chemicals that can release the energy when you are using the batteries. So just think about your phone batteries as a mini chemical plant. When you shuffle the lithium from one electrode to the other, you can actually store and convert electricity to electrical energy.
And lithium is one of those metals that move from one to the other and generate that electricity. And it's really ideal because of its weight, right? It's light and conductive.
That's right. Yeah. So if you recall the periodical table, the lithium is called group one metal. And underneath lithium, we have sodium, potassium. Yeah, I just want to make one important note here. Actually, the lithium metal is a white powder, white silvery metal, like you said. But the lithium run in our battery is in the ionic form. It's called a lithium ion batteries. So most of the batteries are quite safe because there is no actual metals in the batteries when it's operating.
And that's a good segue into the next question that I have. Extracting lithium, that white silvery powder from the ground, isn't what I think people would imagine when we talk about renewable energy and green cars. It's a pretty environmentally disruptive process.
Yeah, I think a majority of the lithium, the highly concentrated lithium source are in countries like Bolivia, Australia. Yeah, so in the US, we actually do have less lithium reserve. The extraction process of lithium is indeed quite CO2 and energy intensive. And that definitely poses challenges when we try to produce as much lithium as possible to enable the energy transition.
Yeah, the mining of lithium has quadrupled in recent years, and they don't think it's anywhere close to the increasing demand. But yeah, the more I learned about how it's done, sometimes it's chemical leaching to bring the lithium to the surface. There's a ton of water that goes into extraction. And I was like, okay, so all these batteries aren't that great to mine, and then they're also kind of dangerous to recycle.
So I think it's a very important point you bring up about the safety concerns with lithium-ion batteries. However, I want to champion a little bit of our field because we ship out about over billions lithium-ion cells. So if you think about the product quality as a part per billion, actually, the safety record is not that bad. It's because lithium is a commodity everywhere. However, I think the scientists do work on how to further improve the safety so that it's actually safe for you to have a larger batteries at your garage or in your household. Yeah, the recycling definitely poses more challenges because after the battery is being used, it actually become chemically more unstable. So we are actually searching for a very creative method that we can actually recycle batteries safely. So operating of the battery recycling facility for lithium ion obviously need a major upgrade compared to lead acid battery recycling. And we are working on the solutions. Hopefully we will deliver to the public very soon.
Well, that's great. I also want to talk about some alternatives. The one that particularly caught my eye and prompted this segment is using sodium, which isn't that salt?
That's right. Yeah, I sometimes call those the magic salt. Yeah, so they are actually, really based on the sodium ion batteries. Is actually based on similar principles as lithium ion batteries. However, instead of lithium as the working ions, we make sodium ion. The ions move back and forth between the two electrodes. And on the periodic table, sodium, even though it's bigger compared to lithium, but actually in the material science, we call it mobility. The mobility of sodium can be actually faster than that of lithium ion. Being bigger and faster, I guess the Americans are very familiar with this concept. And it's actually happening in the sodium ion batteries. And more importantly, the US is one of the largest sodium ash deposit area. So in fact, we can actually get the sodium salt with a much less energy intensive and water intensive process.
I also understand that sodium batteries might last longer.
We are working on it. Yeah, at the moment, only in the small lab prototypes that we can actually demonstrate certain chemistries for sodium ion batteries can compete with lithium ion phosphate or lithium nickel manganese cobalt oxide, this kind of battery chemistries. Our challenge is really those chemistries for based on sodium have to be scaled at a similar gigawatt hour capacity as lithium, and that is not an easy job.
I also understand that sodium's heavier, so it makes the batteries more heavy.
That's right. Yeah, I think that the weight for sodium ion is indeed higher than that of lithium ion. However, there are a lot of interesting engineering designs that one can implement to make at least the volumetric energy density of the sodium ion battery. So it means energy per liter. We are trying very hard to see if we can make it as close as lithium possible. And I want to also emphasize that last 30 years since lithium ion was commercialized in 1992, it played such a pivotal role in our daily life to enable our power our electronics and power the cars and now the grid. I think lithium ion is not replaceable. However, we provide sodium ion batteries as another option when we actually do the energy transition, because as you could imagine, how wonderful it is if you can choose on the shelf whether you want lithium ion batteries or sodium ion batteries based on your budget, your requirement for the user cases. I think that's a wonderful scenario to think about.
Yeah, when in prepping for this hour, I also read that, you know, when it comes to the weight of it, if you're doing large batteries, the batteries that store power from wind farms, from solar farms, maybe weight isn't such a huge consideration because those batteries are just going somewhere and they're just going to sit and collect that energy.
Yes, Anna, you are spot on. Yeah, I think the sodium ion batteries are looking very much into this large scale grid storage. In the grid storage, the weight and the volume is not a main concern unless you live in the New York City,
yes.
Where they will become important. However, I think you're right that sodium ion batteries will play an important role complementing what lithium ion is doing for the mobility sector. But regardless, I believe the properties or the performances of the sodium ion batteries has to be as good as lithium ion batteries in order to the for the consumers to enjoy the product.
You're also researching metal air batteries, solid state batteries. What are these?
Yeah, those are the what we call it a future battery technologies where might enable applications that one has never imagined, maybe only in the science fiction. So one of the things I always say is flying cars will become a reality in our lifetime. So metal air batteries present a possibility to produce batteries with extreme high energy density, particularly gravimetric energy density, the energy per energy and power per kilogram. And when we enable those type of high energy batteries, urban mobility, air travel will be different, I think, especially if you're stuck in the traffic of Los Angeles and Chicago. And for solid state batteries, I think it is a dream for all the battery scientists that in the future, people will have a refrigerator for electrons at home. And that refrigerator, you know, you store water and food at home, but think about how much your life needs electrons. So if you have a refrigerator of electrons at home, that refrigerator must be ultimately safe and it has absolutely no possibilities to catch fire or have thermal events. And that's where I think a lot of the driving force for doing solid state batteries, all solid state batteries is possible to present us an opportunity to have the battery with very high energy and power, can be fast charged, yet very safe. And you can put it at the home and forget about it. So that's the dream that we are working on. We hope that it will become a reality in the next decade.
So instead of like a gas generator for power outages, you have a battery somewhere that could run your whole house for a couple days?
Yes, that's the right analogy. And hopefully, you know, those batteries also can provide, you know, other alternative benefits. You know, sometimes, you know, I would say that in the case of extreme weather conditions, I think having those electric battery, I would say refrigerator for electrons, definitely provide people some resilience towards, you know, extreme weathers.
I love that idea. How many years away are we from having a tiny battery refrigerator in our basements?
I believe a lot of brilliant entrepreneurs and engineers are already working on those concepts. I think that you know, those ideas has been around for a while. Although, you know, the difficulty is always that the safety of the batteries still have not reached that criteria yet. But I hope that if I, you know, have to really make a prediction for the future. Hopefully by 2030, between 2030 to 2035, 10 to 12 years, we certainly hope that some of the household in the suburban areas will start to implement this type of refrigerator for electrons.
I love it. Who knew batteries like was such a fascinating and exciting topic? I was so thrilled by how interesting this turned out to be. I wonder, you know, we obviously are increasingly using renewable energies, but we also are really increasing our need for electricity with artificial intelligence. Do you guys think about that in terms of your work with batteries and the need to constantly be increasing the size of our grid?
That's a really excellent question. I actually know the fact that the supercomputers, you know, take a lot of power. And from our perspective, I would say that it seems that nuclear power is coming back because of this increasing demand on the grid. So I think batteries, regardless that what is the main power source, the battery will play an important role in the future grid to ensure the quality of the grid. But I also have to admit that batteries' scaling speed may not keep pace with the increasing demand on the AI. This is one of the reasons, although I'm a battery person and I'm also pro-nuclear, I think that we will need alternative solution as well, even though the batteries we are working really hard to make the grid more stable and enable more carbon-free source. I do think that we cannot solve all the problems. The AI one is something that give me, you know, really make me stay awake at night, think about, you know, what other battery options we can have. So alternative battery storage solution, perhaps like flow batteries, large scale organic flow batteries or aqueous batteries, still yet to be invented to actually meet the demands of the increasing electricity. I think that those questions remain to be answered.
Yeah. We have an electric car at home, so I think I spend a lot of time thinking about batteries and where to charge and how to charge them. And I'm just so fascinated by the idea because I think the battery in our car, you know, costs about $70,000 to replace. It weighs hundreds and hundreds of pounds. The idea that one day it may be small and lightweight is unfathomable to me, that I could probably pick up the battery on my own.
Yeah, I won't recommend doing that now,
No.
Yeah, for the refrigerator at home, we certainly hope people will be able to handle it with your, you know, like a appliance, electric appliance at home. For the car, I do want to say that electric cars based on today's lithium-ion batteries is already fascinating. I mean, I've been driving mine for over 6 years. I think the charging infrastructure really depends on where you live.
Yeah.
But I would also say that in certain areas, particularly with cold winter, we need to even plan the charging infrastructure even better, because the car does consume more for heating. And so the batteries, I think the future directions, there's still a lot we can improve. I promise the public that in the near future, we can make batteries work at a cold winter, like a minus 40 C or minus 30 C.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
It's coming on your way. Yeah, and then we also want to make sure that there will be options that people can actually swap batteries if possible. And when you make batteries very safe, battery swapping is actually one of the possible pathway as well. So yeah, all sorts of options are possible with batteries. I hope, Anna, you keep an eye on, you know, all the new things coming out from the battery field. Certain things, you know, may take a little bit longer time, a bit effort, but I think the momentum is definitely here. So we are definitely seeing that batteries are becoming a really important part of the everyday life of everyone.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on when that refrigerator finally becomes available.
I think we have to work extra hard to show you the actual prototype.
Yeah. That was Shirley Meng, Professor of Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, would you trust your car to pump the brakes for you? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our next topic is how automatic braking systems in vehicles are getting better at preventing collisions and saving lives. So the federal government is pushing for these systems to get more intelligence at faster speeds. But that sort of raises the question, do you trust your car to brake for you? Joining me to talk about it is Ariane Marshall, transportation reporter for Wired. Ariane, welcome to All Sides.
Hi there.
So first, let's start with the simple question. How does automatic braking systems work? How does my car know it needs to stop quickly?
Yeah, so the way these systems work on cars that are, you know, being put out today and have been put out for the last several years is that they come equipped with cameras, sometimes LIDARs, basically a sensor suite that can essentially see ahead down the road and sense when there is a person or car or even sometimes bicycle that you are about to collide with. And they're the suppliers who put out these sensors then kind of give over the technology to individual automakers who decide using algorithms to kind of tune them to how sensitive they are. So different automakers make different choices about, you know, what sorts of things their systems are going to respond to. But basically the upside of it is that these systems in general are built to avoid collisions at kind of slightly slower speeds. So not quite highway speeds, but usually the speed you'll go on like a residential street or maybe even a little bit of a faster local road.
Yeah, and there's been some research by AAA about the effectiveness of this. And when they compare 2017 vehicles, 2018 vehicles to 2024 vehicles, it looks like they're getting better at this.
Yeah, so there was some really kind of encouraging news out about road safety from AAA earlier this year. As you said, they compared vehicles that were model year 2017, 2018 to model year 2024 vehicles. And they found that the automatic emergency braking systems in those newer cars were twice as likely to avoid collisions at speeds up to 35 miles per hour. And the majority of the newer cars also avoid hitting a stationary target, a non-moving target at 45 miles per hour too. So we talked to a few experts and they said, you know, this is sort of unqualified, really great news for road safety. These systems are moving in the right way. There's, you know, been some improvements in technology that are really great and saving people's lives.
Yeah, so the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration now wants them, all cars, to be able to stop and avoid contact with any vehicle in front of them by 2029, and they want it to go up to 60 miles an hour. Is that a huge leap in a short period of time?
That is a pretty big leap. I think whether it's a short period of time depends on who you're talking to. So the federal government, I think, is also sort of heartened by this good news about automatic emergency braking. The way these systems got into the cars we have today, it was actually came down to a voluntary agreement that automakers made with a road safety group back in 2016. And they met their ambitious goals, which was by the end of 2023, these systems were on 95% of new cars. I think it's now up to 99%. So that was all great news. Now, the Fed saw that and said, hey, let's make this not just a voluntary agreement, but a mandate and really push the industry to have these systems work in more situations. So as you said, they are now supposed to, by 2029, work up to 62 miles per hour, so at fast highway speeds, and also avoid pedestrians in both daytime and critically nighttime, which is proven challenging in some contexts for these systems. This has, as I said, been a bit controversial. The main lobbying group for automakers in Washington, D.C. Made quite a fuss earlier this year. They said, you know, we don't think this is technically possible by 2029, and we think it's going to cost a lot more than the federal government thinks it is to put this technology inside cars. And, you know, the implication there is that they're going to pass on those costs to the folks who buy cars, which is going to up car prices.
Yeah, that was my next question about what these new features would cost car buyers, because anyone who's bought a car lately may have lamented just how expensive they're getting.
Yeah, so there are so many reasons why cars have gotten more expensive lately, but some of it does have to do with this increasingly sophisticated technology that we're seeing put into cars. Now, some of these are related to safety systems like automatic emergency braking, and some of them are just also related to kind of slick features that you'll find on new cars. What the automakers have said is that they think this will cost up to, it could be less, but up to $4,000 per car for them to put this new system into cars by 2029. The federal government doesn't really buy that. They say it'll probably be closer to somewhere between $80 and $360. Now,
Those are a huge difference.
they are huge differences. And also, I'd say, in sort of the in terms of how much a car costs these days, which I think the average price right now is somewhere in the $40,000 range for a luxury car, it's over $60,000. That's kind of a drop in the bucket. But yes, this potentially could add a bit of price to what you're seeing at the dealership.
Yeah, and these braking systems are not perfect. There are false positives or so-called phantom braking. They sometimes incorrectly identify hazards. US regulators have investigated a handful of automakers for these issues that actually resulted in driver injury. So, I mean, this technology, like any technology, it works until it doesn't.
Yeah, definitely. I will say that all of the safety researchers I talked to for this story were pretty unequivocal. They said, we've done a lot of research on this. We find that this technology is sort of an unmitigated good. It's getting better. Something that comes up with systems like automatic emergency braking, but also other systems that are advanced driver assistance systems, things like lane keeping. When those first started going into cars, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, the one research, or actually, I should say, several research studies suggested that people are really annoyed by them. And the way that they could tell that people were annoyed by them is because when people took their cars to get serviced, the people who were servicing them noticed that people were turning those systems off. So people were deciding, hey, this doesn't really work. My car keeps beeping at me. I don't really understand why it's happening. It's really annoying. It's interrupting my drive. I'm just going to turn this off. They're finding that is not happening nearly as much anymore, which seems to indicate that people not only are finding this less annoying, but maybe even are finding that it's kind of saving them on the roads. So it's I've heard some anecdotes for sure about people who have had issues, gotten whiplash, had some really unpleasant situations on the road, and there have been those handful of investigations into automakers that it seems have sort of incorrectly tuned this technology. But again, I will say that the road safety researchers seem to be pretty settled on this. They think this technology is really great and are preventing injuries on the road.
I wonder how these automatic braking systems fit into the conversation about driverless cars, because it feels like this technology, getting it right, is essential and critical if we're going to go in that direction.
Yeah, for sure. And the work is sort of related in that it's depending on sensors that are placed outside and sometimes inside a car to feed information back into the vehicle, which then uses algorithms to kind of decide what it's going to do at any given time. Now, of course, the problem of self-driving cars is so much more complex than just automatic emergency braking. It has to determine whether to stop or go in all contexts, in all situations. It doesn't matter how fast or how slow it's going, or whether the target is moving or not moving, or if the car itself is turning or not turning. So it's a much more complex technological problem. And that's why you're not seeing automakers, for example, make any sort of pledges about including that technology on cars that will be around in the next decade or so. But it is sort of a related technical problem. And I think it gets to some big questions that automakers really have to deal with, which is in this weird kind of period where we know self-driving cars are technically possible, we still have to remind drivers that even though these systems are pretty good, they really do need to pay attention on the
Oh,
road.
yeah.
Even if your car has automatic emergency braking, even if your car, for example, you have a Tesla that comes with this product called full self-driving. It's not actually full self-driving. You really do need to pay attention at all times and really be ready to take over at the wheel, hit that brake whenever you're behind the steering wheel of a car.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I also wonder about the maintenance of things like this. So, I mean, increasingly our cars are essentially computers on wheels, but all those little sensors, all those little cameras, the ones that even the backup cameras, the ones that even show you like a bird's eye top-down view of your car and where it's going. I mean, all of that costs money to maintain, particularly if it goes bad or the wires break. I mean, I feel also like the maintenance of cars is getting more expensive.
Oh my gosh, yes, you're right on the money on that one. I don't have the figures off the top of my head, but there's been a lot of research that's shown that that cars have gotten much more expensive to repair, and of course that affects insurance costs as well for folks. And that also affects the sorts of jobs that technicians are doing. There's been such a huge change in the world of auto repair. The image that we have of that guy who kind of gets into the guts and he's covered in grease and fixing the car with his hands. It's now a much more technical job that's much more appealing to people who are really into computers because it is so much about sensor calibrations. If your sensor calibration is off, gosh, these systems can go haywire because they are not exactly sure where the car is in space. So it definitely makes the entire, auto maintaining project more complex.
Yeah, my car this morning must have got a little bit of snow or something on it because I got an alert and it's like your front camera is obscured, your braking is not working, and I'm like, okie
Yeah, right, exactly. Like who would have thought that you'd have to think about your car's cameras? It's like
I know. I feel like I'm
it
dating
seems kind of
myself with
silly,
that.
but yeah, but it is true that some of these technologies are seem to be really making us better drivers, and making us safer drivers. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, especially as we age, my mother's getting up there in years, and she loves she gets alerts if somebody is in her blind spot. She gets alerts if she would cross the median. She has all these little bells and whistles, and it actually gives her the confidence to drive longer.
Yeah, that's really great to hear, and that's something I hear from safety researchers as well. That it just makes people feel more confident in the road, and that can just translate to better driving.
That was Wired transportation reporter Ariane Marshall. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, CNET's Russell Hawley is giving us his tech recommendations for all the teenagers in our lives. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. The holidays are creeping ever closer, and anyone who has a teenager in their life knows just how hard it can be to find a gift that'll actually put a smile on their face. Here to help us is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Hawley, with his annual gift guide for the teens in your life. Russell, welcome back.
Thank you.
So the first item on your list for teens is a PlayStation Portal, which at first glance I was like, oh, it's like a Nintendo Switch, but it's not. It is a fancy controller?
It's a little bit of both. It was when it originally released, the PlayStation Portal was actually not something that we recommended super often because it was just kind of a fancy controller. It had a screen in the middle so that if you were on the same wireless network or if you had a really great mobile connection, you could play games from your PlayStation 5, but you had to actually own that PlayStation 5 and it had to be somewhere, you know, with your games already loaded on it. And you couldn't just play in the cloud the same way you could with Xbox Game Pass or with Steam streaming or, you know, some of the other options that are available out there right now. But in this last week, Sony has made an update to the PlayStation Portal that allows for cloud-based gaming, which means it now is a lot closer to what you would get from a Nintendo Switch. And that makes the, you know, kind of price tag that goes along with that a lot more interesting.
Yeah. So you don't need a PlayStation 5 or you still would need one to play?
You don't need a PlayStation 5 in order to play most PlayStation games now through the PlayStation Portal. So if a brand new game comes out and you want to play it and you just don't sit in front of your television super often, or you are, you know, someone who is in a position to not have a television in your room, not necessary. Like you can have this and you can still have as close to the full gaming experience as you would if you had a PlayStation 5 sitting in front of you.
All right. So what does this run us?
This is $200, which actually in some cases makes it slightly less expensive than a Nintendo Switch, but it lacks the same amount of battery life that you would get with a Nintendo Switch. And it doesn't have any of the like multiplayer features that come with it. So it really depends if you're, you know, kind of stuck deciding between one of those two purchases. It really just depends on the kind of gamer you are. If you really enjoy kind of social playing and having friends around and something that you can kind of bring everywhere, Nintendo's probably the way you want to go still. But if you are, you know, a big fan of either solo gaming or more intense online gaming, then the PlayStation Portal may be the right thing for you.
How is the screen? So you always sort of wonder, like, do you have to squint to see the games or is the screen big enough to really handle most of what's played on PlayStation?
I find that it is more than enough to play the games on PlayStation. It is it's not, you know, as small as a phone screen, but it is certainly not like iPad sized. It's really kind of somewhere in the middle. So if you have if you are like me and have to wear glasses constantly and you kind of struggle with, you know, maybe screens in low light or something like that, you may want to pick one up and try it first before buying it or, you know, giving it as a gift. But if you find that playing a game on your phone is not something you struggle with, you're going to have a lot of fun with this experience.
I also think it's great for a family that doesn't have multiple televisions in the home. Like if you have one television, if that's your prerogative and it's in your living room or your family room, this might be a great gift so that you're not fighting over who has control of the TV.
That is exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, not only are you not fighting over it, but neither party is losing anything in that experience. You know, like by having everything contained on that screen with a nice set of headphones, you really are getting the same gaming experience.
I also think, you know, we're talking about gifts for teenagers in our lives, but I also think it could be great if you live with a partner who likes to game and you don't have multiple televisions in your home.
That is exactly right. And very much depends on the kind of game you're playing. You're seeing a lot of that exact same experience with the more expensive, but also considerably more functional Steam Deck for, you know, couples who play online games together or, you know, like traditional PC games. But yeah, that is definitely a thing that is happening in quite a few relationships that I am in my immediate social circle.
No, it's great. If you live in a one bedroom apartment, you've only got the one TV in the house and it's a really nice way to compromise.
Or if you've only got one nice TV. Nobody wants to like be the one that's kind of relegated to the less good TV for a thing that they're excited about. So yeah, I think it's a win either way.
Yeah, and at $200, it's pretty reasonable. That's cheaper than the Switch.
That is exactly right. Yeah, and when it originally was announced, it didn't really seem like it was like a bargain because you still had to have a $600 console in order to play it on. But with that going away, I really think that this is a much more valuable option for folks.
Your next suggestion is a self-heating mug, the Ember Temperature Control Smart Mug. So what about this is going to make a teen smile?
I have teenagers in my life. I have teenagers in my life who will sit up and play video games until 2 o'clock in the morning or just chat online with friends. And few things frustrate most of the parents of those teenagers more than the 2 a.m. I'm going to make myself a new cup of tea or hot chocolate or something like that and make a ton of noise in the kitchen and kind of wake everyone up. The Ember mug is something that I recommend to a ton of different age groups, but for teenagers especially, you know, you can make that drink, you can keep it on this warmer, and you're not going to forget about it and let it go cold.
Yeah, it's $80 for a coffee mug, so it's not cheap.
This is not cheap, but you set a precise temperature and it will keep it at that temperature. It has a base that charges the cup that also acts as, you know, like a rest for it, that you can have at a desk or at a bedside table. And the battery on it, from my experience, depending on what the temperature set at, it will keep it at that temperature for anywhere between 3 and 5 hours before you need to bring it back to a charger. Which is great for someone, again, like myself, who will leave a coffee cup somewhere in the house and forget that it's there and then find it later and have to toss it in a microwave or something to heat it back up.
Or someone who's maybe sipping their coffee as they're getting ready in the morning. And, you know, by the time they're finished with their makeup, I don't know who I'm talking about here. Perhaps the coffee's gone cold.
Exactly. There are a lot of different people that this apply to. And I really, you know, it has come down quite a bit in price. When this mug was first released, it was closer to $150, which made it a lot more challenging to recommend. But at $80, I think if you are someone who frequently struggles with this particular problem, it's worth the investment.
It also has an app, which I find really fascinating. So you can set your exact temperature. I drink my coffee a little cooler than the average human. So it is kind of nice to think that I could just set it at exactly what I want. It's that, like, it's persnickety, but it's also kind of nice.
It is really nice. And it's one of those things that you're starting to see in a ton of different home tech, especially if you are the kind of person who has an electric kettle at home. Mm. Being able to set your boiling temperature to be, you know, kind of specific, I think is something that's becoming more and more popular.
Yeah, some of the online reviews commented on its weight, saying the mug feels heavy in a good way. It, like, feels sturdy and well made, which, I mean, if you're going to spend $80 on a coffee mug, you definitely want it to have a nice feel in your hands.
It does feel nice to hold, and the weight, you know, comes from the battery. And it's really important to understand that the battery and the heating element and stuff, they're all in the bottom, which means you're a lot less likely to tip this thing over because there's not as much weight, you know, kind of at the top of the mug. I am also a collector of very weird mugs, and I notice that sometimes I will get mugs that are quite heavy at the top, and those are the ones that I consistently knock over. Whereas with Ember, I am far less likely to do so.
It comes in a variety of colors. It also comes in a 10-ounce and a 14-ounce, which is important. That bigger size is definitely
important.
Nice. But you cannot put it in the dishwasher. And this is my drawback, because it's something I've come to learn about myself, is I'm not the kind of person who will hand wash their mugs. So you kind of got to know that about who you are.
That is very true. You definitely want to hand wash this because, again, it's got a big old battery in it. But yeah, if you are not you know, gonna struggle with that, then this will work pretty well for you.
The auto sleep feature also looks pretty cool. So, like, if you don't touch the mug for an hour, it just stops heating. Like, it knows when it's been jostled.
Yeah, so this is an important option for folks who either don't want to completely drain the battery or don't want to risk you know, first thing in the morning knocking over a mug of, you know, something that is 100 degrees. You know, that is the thing. Having it automatically turn off is super valuable and safe if you are also the kind of person to set your mug on top of something that might react poorly to heat.
The third item on your list for teenage tech gifts is actually something I've been debating for myself for quite a while. It's the Hatch Sunrise Alarm Clock. So kind of pricey, but it does a whole bunch of stuff.
You can't, you know, throw a rock without hitting a research paper about how sleep impacts teenagers, you know, both in how much sleep they need and the way in which they are woken up in the morning in order to catch a bus or, you know, get to class. Sunrise clocks introduce, you know, very specific light at very specific color temperatures in order to make the wake up process just a lot less stressful. And I know that there are folks who are, you know, of my age who would laugh at the idea of waking up being considered stressful, but, like, there's an enormous amount of science behind this, and the difference that this makes, especially in, you know, kind of growing bodies, is significant. So yeah, that's definitely something that I made sure was on my list for a lot of different recommendations this year.
Yeah, it's also a sound machine. It does white noise. It does nature sounds. There's a dimmable clock, so if you're struggling to sleep, you have to willfully, like, hit it to see the time.
That's right.
Comes with an app for your phone. And, you know, there are tons of sunrise alarm clocks on the market. What makes the Hatch worth it?
Hatch is worth it just from what you just mentioned. There are so many different things that attach to it. There are a bunch of different sunrise clocks. You can also, if you're looking for just kind of like the bare minimum, I think right now the Amazon's Echo Glow, which is a light source that can, be set into the Amazon ecosystem to automatically do stuff, that's like $30. So a much more, kind of affordable option there, but it's the same basic concept. This just also adds a white noise machine for people who prefer, those background noises when they're going to sleep. And as you pointed out, the light sensitivity, which is something that I, have always struggled with. And so having something that I know isn't going to be sharing light in my eyes when I'm actually trying to sleep, it just makes it a lot more valuable for my needs.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking about with this too is there's a lot of conversation, debate, and literature about the time that high school starts, the time that middle school starts here in Central Ohio. A lot of you get up earlier the older you get, which sometimes is counterintuitive to how like teenagers' circadian rhythms work. And so
That's right.
I thought it was really interesting to think about, I mean, if your teenage, like how we wake them up and if there's a better way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much research that has gone into the way that, kind of naturally or artificially recreating sunlight as a way to wake you up is, that kind of slowly getting brighter thing is just much better for us as, kind of folks who struggle to wake up. And so yeah, that is something that it's a weird kind of rabbit hole to go down, but once you start reading those studies, the changes that you start making in your life, I find are pretty interesting.
Yeah, also, I think there's a reason we all have some sort of like Pavlov's dog visceral reaction to the sound of our alarm clocks. Like, even if I hear that particular chime that I use on my phone to wake up out in the wild, I'm like, oh, geez.
That is exactly right. Yeah. And there are certain types of people who absolutely need those. And that's why they make those alarm clocks that also have those great big like vibration things that you put underneath your pillow to
I love the
also.
ones that like take off running and you've got to go chase it.
Those are very funny, but I think if I had one of those in my house, the chances of it surviving without,
Oh,
suffering some
no.
kind of terrible damage is very low.
Before I let you go for this hour, I did want to ask you a quick question about AI home security because artificial intelligence has wormed its way into every new technology that is getting released. And one where it could be making a major impact is in our home security systems and in image recognition. What is going on there?
Yeah, so this is something that has become, more popular now, but it's something that has been in development way before AI kind of became the buzzword that it is right now. And that is that, cameras using, kind of pattern recognition to know the difference between a cat walking by your front door and a person walking by your front door. So, 5 years ago, the front door cameras basically had a single, trigger for any kind of motion that walked past your house whatsoever. And while that is helpful in some situations, if you are in the middle of a meeting or hosting a radio show, having your phone go off every 30 seconds because, someone is moving in next door, can not be very helpful or productive in keeping your home safe. One of the big things that has happened in the last couple of years is being able to have just a ton of control over when and how those notifications go off and when and how those things are recorded. And with that also comes better battery life because it's not, kicking the camera on every single time there's a tree that is moving in, your neighborhood. And that is one of those areas that is dramatically better by all of the machine learning and AI that has been put into it. There is kind of a side conversation to that, which is how that would impact the way that porch pirates interact with security cameras on their front doors, and whether we are kind of creating a better mousetrap by, creating an environment where folks who are porch pirates are going to become more clever in the way that they approach your door to make sure that those alarms don't go off.
Oh, that's interesting. I also think, we'll miss out on all those like funny animal videos from people's Ring doorbells that appear on like TikTok and other social media sites.
That is exactly right. I suspect that some of those will go down. You'll always have folks who are more interested in wanting to know every single thing that's happening outside. So they'll, those aren't going to go away entirely, I suspect. But yeah, we'll probably end up seeing less of them.
I wonder if it could also ever get good enough to recognize the people who live in the home. So it maybe you don't need to be alerted when your spouse comes home, or you're like maybe you do want to be alerted when your kid comes home from school. So setting that preference for faces that it just knows as residents.
There are early versions of that with Google's Nest system that will make sure that the face lines up with the code that gets entered into the door. So if your kid has a special code that acknowledges when they've come in and out of the house, but it's not that person that uses the code, then that's kind of a different flag that gets used and sends a
Oh.
warning to the parent, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's actually really fascinating. Are these, do they cost more, these kind of specialty systems?
No, a lot of this is being, kind of slowly added to, Ring and Nest and some of the other companies that are coming out there. At the moment, it's really kind of a race to see which company can add more of these features on, and cost hasn't at the moment gone up as a result of that, but we'll see how that goes in the next year.
Yeah. And so next week, what is your gift? Who are we giving gifts for next week when we hear from you?
Next week we are going to be focusing on adults,
Ah, the things
kids
we
of
all want.
kids of grander stature, we'll put it that way.
Kids who might have just a smidge of gray hair.
That's exactly right.
That was managing editor for commerce at CNET, Russell Holly. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.